and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
Well, good morning, Jem. What topic of great historical importance are we going to be discussing on our podcast today?
Well, I thought that we were both such learned gentlemen that we should talk about the history of law or legal processes.
Oh, indeed. I think that's a fantastic idea. I shall get my dictionary of long and complicated words out just so that I can give it the right attitude and the right atmosphere within the context of a legal debate. So the history of law, I mean, where do we go back to? Because there's always got to have been presumably some sort of law in place. There's always got to have been some requirement for people to follow, some general understanding of what is appropriate behaviour. But law is more than just a moral code, a set of behaviours. It's actually in some way got to be inscribed. It's in some way got to be laid down. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. And of course, right at the beginning, like we were talking, for example, about magic, if we're talking about, as you just said, a moral list of rules, quite often it's linked with religion. But the first proper laws, list of you must do this and you must do that, etc., is something called Hammurabi's Code, which comes from, like a lot of our stuff, from the ancient Babylonian area region. And it is a list of sort of fairly straightforward laws and regulations. Perhaps the most interesting one that always stuck in my mind is that if a builder built a house and the house collapsed on the family, the builder must be executed because he's killed the family who were in the building. And there's a certain logic to that. I'm pretty sure that's going to make modern architects get a little bit sweaty under the collar. But you can absolutely see a dotted line from Hammurabi to things like the Ten Commandments. You know, it is a sort of eye for an eye type series of laws, but at least everybody knows where they are with laws. And if you like, just to start the sort of conversation off, the most important thing about laws is whether you agree with them or disagree with them. If they are written down, everybody knows the rules, and therefore you can't be surprised if you break the rules, you get punished in some way. Maybe it's a particularly harsh punishment, but the point is it's no longer arbitrary. And quite often when you see evil dictatorships or periods of complete anarchy or revolution, the problem there is nobody knows exactly what the laws and rules are. And that's a very scary situation to be in.
But I think actually it's one of those things that we cross over with the ancient societies. When we're talking about the Hammurabi Code or something like that, I glossed over that quickly because I couldn't quite remember if that was the word you used. But when we're talking about something like,
nobody noticed. No.
Yeah. When we're talking about something like that or the Ten Commandments or anything like that, the thing about that is it was very easy to know what the laws were, because you've got one simple set of laws, one simple set of codes. And I think the trouble is that as time has moved on, looking at sort of the world today, one of the big problems is, and this is an argument, a debate that I have with people a lot, but one of the big problems today is there is nobody who knows every single law in place in England. It's something that's come up with all the debate about European laws and everything else, suddenly this huge problem that actually there's no way you can know every single law. You've got to have lawyers trained in very, very specific areas. If your law is very simple, if you build a house and it falls down on somebody's head, then you get killed, then everybody can know that, everyone can follow that. But you get to this point where there is just so much today, so many intricacies of law. I spent a lot of time recently, I think I mentioned in this podcast, just trying to find one tiny little detail of copyright law. And that, I think, is where law gets a bit silly and a bit dense and a bit boring. But it'd be good fun if we go back to sort of the beginnings of law, where I think law was much, much simpler, much more direct. And as you say, house falls down on somebody's head, the guy that builds it gets killed. A very direct, to the point style of law.
Look, I agree. And what's interesting is if you look at Europe, everything is fundamentally based or a reaction to Roman law. But just before we get to Roman law, it's worth just mentioning the ancient Greeks a little bit, because they've had their own influences. I'm pretty sure most people have heard of the term rhetoric. You know, the most famous bit of rhetoric is the rhetorical question. But the if you want to think about what rhetoric is seen as the pinnacle of public speaking, and definition is the illusion of having a conversation with an audience, which you can't possibly have. But if people in the audience are sitting there thinking, oh, they're talking my language, they're absolutely seeing my point of view, then you're probably going to win them over. Quite often that's used in politics, but we actually know who invented it. It's a guy called Corax of Syracuse. Syracuse is now in modern day Sicily, but it was a Greek colony back in the day. This is in the BCs, a few centuries back in the BCs. And Corax of Syracuse was a lawyer. And the way ancient Greek law worked is that all court cases, if it was petty theft or high treason, they were all heard in one day, from sun up to sundown. The idea about this is everybody would gather at the court of law, and they would then randomly select some people to be the jury. And because nobody knew who was going to be on the jury, and by the end of the day, the jury was dismissed because the case was over, that was the ancient Greeks' way of attempting to stop jury tampering. So you only had a day to get your point across. And anyway, the point about Corax of Syracuse is he invented rhetoric not to find out who did or didn't win what was the truth of the case. He did it to win. And so, you know, this, if you could sway the audience your way, if you could be a bit of a rabble rouser, you were more than likely to win the legal case. And indeed, I think it was Socrates. Somebody's going to tell me that, you know, maybe that's wrong. I don't know. But that one of the famous philosophers was sentenced to death because he worked the system to his disadvantage. He was given a fairly minor crime, and he basically said, look, you also got to choose, the person accused got to choose what the penalty was on a number of circumstances. And he basically said, okay, well, you either let me off this or you put me to death. And he figured that that would be such a severe punishment, nobody would possibly condemn them to death. But in the end, they turned out to be guilty, so they had to carry out the crime. And if it wasn't Socrates, it was Plato. It was one of the big ones. I forget which one now. But yeah, the point was they tried to work the system and it really backfired. But yeah, I think that if you're a modern person listening to that, you can spot the problems with it. But also there's a certain simple elegance. You were just mentioning about how complicated modern law is. And absolutely, that you're right. There is no such thing as just a lawyer nowadays. You have to be a defense lawyer or a prosecution lawyer. You have to be an expert in civil law or criminal law or business law. You know, there are all these different branches from the core area of let's have a discussion to work out what's the right way forwards.
Exactly. And the law gets more complicated as you start to get into the question of, well, there, you know, we have an unwritten constitution in this country and everything else. So let's stick very, very simple, because I know one of the topics you wanted to bring up, and we're already a third of the way through the podcast, and I do enjoy this subject, is the idea of trial by ordeal of some sort or other.
Yes, so this is in the early medieval era, and it's sort of been picked up on by a lot of people, and people think that it continued for a long time. And whereas technically, yes, you could do some of it into like the Georgian era, the reality was this all happened in the early medieval times when there wasn't a lot of centralized power. And the idea was that God would sort it out for you. And so there were sort of two main flavors. There was trial by ordeal and trial by combat. But the idea fundamentally behind each one was whoever wins, well, that's clearly God showing favor to them, so they must be telling the truth. Trial by ordeal, perhaps the most famous one, is trial by fire, where they get a metal bar and they put it in a brazier and they heat it up so it's sort of sizzlingly red hot. And then they put it in your hand and you then have to walk something like 10 paces with this thing burning in your hand. Then you let go of it, presumably saying, ouch. And then your hand is wrapped up, and then a short amount of time, maybe it's a day, maybe it's a week, you're given like a very short amount of time to heal. And if you've healed, God has clearly blessed you. It is a miracle. And therefore, you get whatever you wanted in that particular court case. The trial by combat is, let's say, me and you, Greg, we have a disagreement over a piece of land. There's no written documentation to prove who owns it. So we literally fight, you know, swords, shields, that kind of stuff. And we actually have a fight over it. Now, even in the medieval era, they worked out that a big guy might just accuse a little guy. So you were allowed to have your champions to fight for you. So you could just have two big 6-footers smashing away at each other. But again, the idea was that whoever won was clearly, no, had nothing to do with ability, had everything to do with God smiling upon them. But even once we're into the high Middle Ages, even the people in the Middle Ages recognized that this was a dumb way to run a legal system. So that, yes, it might have been something that would be familiar to, let's say, Alfred the Great, but it would have been considered incredibly old-fashioned and a little bit silly to someone like Edward III. It went out of fashion as central authority brought more law and order to areas. But it does show a certain element of superstition. We can all see that compared to the ancient Greeks, or indeed the Romans, who had sort of written laws and statutes and things like that, and indeed lawyers as well. If you compare that to the more ancient ways of doing it, that was definitely a step in the wrong direction.
It was. The other side of that is, you say it all died out, but I think the idea that of trial by combat really carries over outside of the legal system. It did get caught up with this whole idea of the laws of honour and the laws of gentlemanly behaviour and everything else. And it did kind of continue in the form of duelling right through, certainly into the 1800s. I forget the date of the last official duel that was fought. But this idea...
You keep going.
Yeah, the idea pervades throughout history of this idea of, oh yes, you've dishonoured me, you say you haven't, well, the correct way to settle this is if we both get our swords and we, under very strict rules of duelling combat and gentlemanly behaviour, we decide who can stick this pointy sword into the other person quickest, because that will prove that that person is correct and just and right and everything else. There has kind of been this continued idea throughout a large part of history, despite the fact that it's no longer sort of the legal idea of trial by ordeal, the idea that whether you're saying God's going to help them win the battle, or whether you're saying, well, it's the person who's best with the sword wins the battle, either way, this suggestion that, oh, well, the person is right is the one that wins a battle, I think is quite an interesting point of view that it continues on. And one other thing I just wanted to mention about the continuation of the whole trial by ordeal thing is, a lot of times you look at something historical like that, you look at trying to take the stone, hold on to the hot burning stone, and you think, well, how does that relate to the modern world? This is something that is old, this is something that's history, and it's something we've both talked about. We've recently written an article together about the idea that history should become, or can be appropriate to today. And what I actually got to thinking about was, if you go into a modern courtroom in Britain today and you go and watch a case, one of the first things that happens is if the... You have choices nowadays, but if the person on the stand chooses to and are Christian, then one of the things the person accused of the crime can do is swear to tell the truth and swear on the Bible. They have to hold the Bible in one hand and they have to swear to tell the truth. And obviously a big part of that logically is the idea that, or if they believe in this book, if they believe in the Bible, they aren't going to start lying once they've got that in their hands. But I think that does also hark back to the days of trial by ordeal, the suggestion that if you were religious, sort of Middle Ages, you know, sort of very, very religious, real fear of sort of God coming down, stepping in, actually burning people alive, witchcraft and everything else, then to stand there holding a Bible and professing that you're going to swear on the Bible, that you're going to tell the truth, for someone to then lie is, in its own way, an incoming of this trial by ordeal, the suggestion that, well, if this person tells a lie, then they will be burned by God.
Now, actually, that I nearly interrupted earlier there, and I apologise for that. But actually, what I was going to interrupt on and what you've just said there ties together quite nicely. Because if we now leap over to America, and coming up now is a spoiler for Hamilton the musical, okay? So you might want to fast forward to the next 60 seconds.
I just want to...
This is history, though.
Rare occasion here, but I just want to point out, Jem's about to bring up a bit of popular culture that I haven't seen. So that doesn't
happen
very often. Don't
worry, I haven't seen it either. But I do know. But the thing is, Alexander Hamilton, who's one of the founding fathers, he had a duel with the vice president of the United States, the one that was at that point the vice president of the United States. It wasn't a sword duel, it was a pistol duel. And the vice president, Aaron Burr, he shot and mortally wounded Alexander Hamilton. And no legal challenge went up against him. This is a vice president that actually committed, you know, we nowadays in the era of hysteria, we get people going, oh, it's as good as murdering them, or, oh, they're a cold-blooded murderer for invading blah blah. And it's like, okay, fine, if you believe that, you believe that. But there is a big difference between signing an order to war and standing in front of a man and shooting him. The vice president did that and literally got away with murder. So, that's one thing. And there's another. There's a sort of like a lingering bit of the trial by combat. He wanted satisfaction, and in boy did he get it. But interestingly, Aaron Burr then went on in my book, The American Presidents and 100 Facts. I had to write one about him, even though he's a vice president. But he then went on to buy a large amount of land in Texas and seems to have wanted to set up his own country, and was therefore tried for high treason because he was trying to basically break away from America. This was after he was vice president, for the record. But the court case basically collapsed. But unsurprisingly, after murdering a man and trying to set up his own country, he'd kind of ruined his political career. So Aaron Burr, the title of that fact is the most dangerous vice president in history. And I think that's a pretty good argument that he is. But anyway, there's that. And the other thing I wanted to mention was Bill Clinton, and going to your point there about swearing on the Bible. Because what's interesting is, in the eye of the law, most people don't realize this, if we're looking at serious crimes, the most serious is murder. Number two is rape, and number three is perjury. Because even if you do or don't believe in God, the point is, if you're caught lying in a court of law, that is incredibly serious because it breaks the whole idea of a legal case. And so when it comes to Bill Clinton, you get a lot of people Democrats trying to defend him, saying, look, the guy had an extramarital affair. Is that the worst thing that a president's done? Well, no, it's not even the worst thing a vice president's done, as I've just pointed out. However, he lied under oath. It got to the point where he was arguing about what the term sexual relations meant. And it's like, oh, come on, we all know what that means. But anyway, the point is, you know, I think Bill Clinton did many good things, but he committed perjury, and you got to call him out for that. That's an absolute black mark against him, much like Richard Nixon ended the Vietnam War, opened the communication with China. But yes, there was Watergate, which is a very big black mark against him. But, you know, if you're going to attack one, you've got to attack the other. You can't just say that, you know, oh, we'll forget about perjury. Perjury is a big deal in the court of law. So, yes, there you could say that this idea of telling the truth is part of it, the echoes of religious belief, but now it's quite literally enshrined in law.
And one other little aspect, I like that whole idea, because when I think of the idea of Bill Clinton, and like you say, it was the fact that Bill Clinton lied, I think, that really was the big thing for a lot of people. To a certain extent, his initial, you know, mistakes became something of a joke. The actual lying was what kind of really was the nail in his coffin, as it were. And I think that's interesting when we talk about, we've spoken about banning books and things on this podcast as well. And one of the interesting things is when we started to discuss the fact that, you know, you see films and everything where a lot of atrocities are occurred, and yet we discussed that when you see that scene where they're burning books, it has that same sort of visceral effect as hearing that somebody's lied in court. It has that idea of, well, hold on, no, the truth. It's the fact that the truth is being destroyed is more important. And then you have to step back and go, oh, but hang on, there was actually a crime that was committed before that as well. But while we're discussing the idea of trial by ordeal, One other little topic I want to bring up was kind of the idea of almost a reverse trial by ordeal. Because when we're looking at the trial by ordeal, so let's go back to that very simple, basic one, the picking up of the stone. You have to pick up the stone. If your hand is healed, then God has protected you. He's looked after you. He's healed your hand. If he hasn't, then you're in trouble. Well, kind of the reverse theory takes place when we're looking at a trial of ordeal, when we're talking about the witch's ducking stool. Of course, another middle-aged thing. The idea being to take a witch. She was sat on a stool on a piece of wood. She was then dunked under the water for several minutes and then wait to see if this witch came out alive. Now, obviously, under the old-fashioned theory of the stone, if she comes out alive, she's been protected by God and therefore she's innocent. Of course, under the modern witches theory, because of sort of, I suppose, the political nature of accusing witches, if they drowned, they were innocent because they hadn't used any secret black magic. If they came up alive, oh, well, in that case, they were a witch and they would have to be hung. Which kind of has this wonderful way of manipulating that idea of trial by ordeal, even if you don't, you know, sort of believe in the actual idea of the God healing, you can at least see the logic when we're talking about something like the stone or the trial by combat. When we end up with the witch's ducking stool, and it's really a nil-sum game, the witch is going to be dead whichever way they cut it. There we're moving it, you know, again, into a sort of legal form of murder.
Well, there are many legal forms of murder, obviously, since you have capital punishment. But what I would say is, just to add to the whole ducking stool thing, is that there was there's an extra layer that a lot of people don't realise, that before they were placed into the water was blessed by a priest, so it became holy water. And therefore, if the woman floats, for example, this must be a sign that the water's pushing her out and rejecting her. And yet what human beings do is, if you're about to go into the water, you go, so you basically fill your lungs. They become two huge balloons of air. And therefore, they always floated. They never drowned, but because that, and therefore it was a foolproof way of proving that the person was a witch. You're quite right. As soon as you're being sent towards the ducking stool or sent towards the river, you're going to die one way or the other. But actually, the amount of women who drowned was tiny. It was, you know, so it seemed to be an infallible way of spotting witches. I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just trying to explain the logic of the people who were doing that at the time.
And so what you're saying is, basically what we should do is, because I believe that the witches float and wood floats and ducks also float, we have to weigh the woman against
her. Ah, Monty Python. Yes, absolutely. Well, look, I've got a couple of other sort of little bits and bobs to throw your way. I appreciate we're sort of heading towards the end of things. But one thing I found interesting is that when Pizarro captured South America, shattered the Incan Empire in the 1500s, we don't have time to do the whole story there. But anyway, what I found interesting is that obviously this instantly became Spanish imperial territory, and the traders started coming in, and the, you know, the equivalent of the landed gentry started coming in. But what was interesting is, initially throughout the whole of South America, lawyers were banned. It was generally seen by medieval or Renaissance Spanish society that basically lawyers had caused so many trouble, so many problems in society, let's try and start afresh without them. Needless to say, fast forwarding 500 years, there are quite literally thousands, if not millions, of lawyers across South America. You need, as soon as you have civilization, you need a legal structure and you need legal representation who are basically the people who've read the relevant laws to help you. And so you may hate them, but they are a necessary evil. And I just always love the fact that after the horrific atrocities carried out by the conquistadors, they drew the line at lawyers. It's like, they're even worse than us. Maybe we shouldn't have any lawyers in our world. And I've got one more to share, but any thoughts on that, Greg?
No, I think we're going to move on. So what's your next one, Jim?
Well, the other one, the last one I'm going to finish on is probably one of the most famous historical and legal documents in British history, which is Magna Carta. And it really annoys me how Magna Carta is quite often explained or remembered, in the sense that it's seen as it is seen as almost like our constitution. But if anybody, it's not long, really. It's really not long. Have a read of it. You'll need a translation. It's in Latin. But when you start reading it, you realize it is not like the American Constitution, which is talking in very grand terms about how humans should act and what they're allowed to have in America. It's very much of its time. There is an entire section on the destruction of the fishing weirs in the Thames, something that obviously politicians are talking about today as well. No, they're not. And the other one is talking about how all foreign armies and mercenaries must be dispersed and moved away from the lands. We're not exactly swimming in French mercenaries today in England, no matter what some people may think. If you're going to argue, is there a thing in Magna Carta that really is important and echoes down the generations? It's simply this. It was the first time in written documentation that said the king is not above the law. The king themselves cannot be arbitrary. They do actually have to apply the laws of the land. But that's as far as you can go. After that, it's about cow taxation, fishing weirs, and mercenaries. And really, it isn't about, you know, an inalienable right that all men are created equal under God, blah, blah, blah. That's other documents. So, yes, Magna Carta. Oh, the other thing is that as soon as Magna Carta was agreed and stipulated at Runnymede, King John continued his war against the barons. The Pope immediately said that it was null and void. So the original Magna Carta of 1215 was irrelevant. But because John died in 1216, his 9-year-old son, Henry III, basically had to do what the baron said to become king. So it was that ratification, that rewritten version of Magna Carta about a year later, that was actually the one that stuck and not the original. Just a little extra fact there for people.
And one of the things there is that does really mark up this whole idea of laws and of archaic laws, and the fact that just because a law was made at a specific point in time doesn't mean that it carries on. And there are two ways I could go there. I don't have time to get into a political debate about whether or not archaic laws should be held up. So I will just say, and I think we've run out of time for me to go too far into this, do take the time to go in and have a look at some of these strange archaic laws that exist. I think one of my favourite ones was, I think it was until not that long ago, I think it was still legal to shoot a Scotsman with a crossbow after midnight on a Sunday or something like that.
Actually, I can help you there. It was actually to kill a Welshman from a churchyard with a longbow. And it was in places like Gloucester along the borders, because I guess back in the 1300s, if you saw a bunch of Welshmen heading towards you, it's probably a revolt. Whereas, yes, that was legal until into the 1990s.
And I believe sort of things like we are still legally required. I think if you're called upon, I think we're all still legally required to, any boy over the age of 10 is still legally required to do an hour's longbow practice on the village green or something similar to that. There are these archaic laws that, you know, really these days are just treated as a bit of a joke. They pop up occasionally on things like QI and other programs and will never be tested. But the idea of, yeah, like you say, harking back and saying, well, the Magna Carta written in 1215, those were the laws laid down and those are the things we should be listening to today. And yes, that means our fishing rights along the weir or whatever it is have any relevance. I think the important thing is laws need updating, and we've seen different ways of doing things. But I think the bottom line, I think the point you've been trying to make through the episode is, yes, I think that the president of America should have to pick hot stones out of a blazing fire to prove whether or not he's telling the truth.
Less people probably want the job if you had to do that after every statement. But yeah, an interesting idea.
Okay, well, moving on, Jim, do you have something you want to plug this week?
Oh, I tell you what, I'm going to go back to Silent Crossroads. I think that the sort of the Sultans has had its big push, but you know, because this is self-published, I think it's always worth reminding people. You know, by the time you hear this, it's going to be April time, and maybe you're starting to think about your summer holidays. Look, for 99p on Kindle, you can get a big historical drama that takes you from World War I into World War II. It's got love, it's got action, it's got adventure. It's also got some bits where you're starting to think, well, what would I do in that rather tough situation as well? So Silent Crossroads, Gem de Duccio, available on Amazon. If you want to spend a bit more, you can get an actual hard copy. But if you want to get it for Kindle, come on, it's less than a cup of coffee. There we go.
And I'm going to put a plug out this week, I think, for... I'll tell you what I'm going to put a plug out for, because I haven't done it in a long time. While you're mentioning books, you can also get a copy of my one and only book, Greg Chapman... what's it called now? Condensed History... Oh, it's been a long time. Condensed Histories, Volume 1, Histories from England. It's something I don't think I've plugged on this podcast for at least 2 years, but the reason it's sprung up to my mind now is because I do have a chapter in there about the Magna Carta, and when I tried to drill down and find out if anything in the Magna Carta still held up as laws back when I wrote it 3 or 4 years ago. So... those are our plugs for today, but our overriding plug, of course, is for this podcast. If you want to help this podcast out, then please go to iTunes or wherever you're listening. It takes about, I've checked, takes about 4.5 seconds to click on the name of our podcast and click the 5-star button. If you've got an extra 30 seconds, then also leave a quick review for us. That does do us a massive deal of help. Any podcast, anything you read, anything you do online, anything where you want to create the help the creators, remember, just ratings and reviews really do help out every one of the little creators across the internet. So for now, thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Gem de Duccio.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And most of all, thank you to everybody listening so that we're not just sitting here talking to ourselves. Thank you all. We'll be back again next week and we'll have another Fast Five on Tuesday. But for now, goodbye and take care.